Today is Sunday, February 5th, 2023. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
Tired-ish, but that's beside the point.
Okay. Donald, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. I must tell you once again how just amazed I was with your oral history, part 8, a few days ago, about the discovery of Lechuguilla Cave. Not only how that discovery would have impacted you and the others that were working on that project, but how it impacted the politics, the friendships, people that claim proprietary right while they worked in a national park which had senior proprietary rights, and how the Park Service would have learned how to manage a bunch of volunteer cavers, which must have kind of been new to everybody. Can you pick that thread up? Maybe I should be more specific. Last time we ended with the park shutting down all access to the cave after a gentleman, I think, named Rick Bridges wanted sole proprietary rights to the new discovery.
Yes.
In the national park. That's where we left it.
Yes, he wouldn't bend on that, and the rest of us were pretty sure he was headed for a cliff with that decision, which he was, as I'm sure you understand.
I do, so, but I'm curious because Rick would have seen, what had happened earlier with that, with Dave Patterson, right? Or not who?
Dave Alvred.
Thank you. And had seen him leave and not come back, and Rick would have known, gee, if this fails, he'll leave and not come back.
In fact, that's where Rick Bridges got his foot in the first place. But if Alvred had been doing things just as Ron Turbo wanted, he could probably have maintained the leadership of the activity for much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, after the Bridges shut off, the rest of the cavers got together and created something that we named the Lechuguilla Exploration and Research Network, or LEARN for short, and made a new proposal to resume a survey in the park or in the Lechuguilla Cave, and that was approved. And I forget the length of the delay in the exploration, but it wasn't the only delay there'd be or the longest one. And anyway, we got back to working in the cave, and the thing was just exploding, essentially in three directions. The eastern branch, which was the first one we found and turned out to be the longest in linear extent, and then the southwestern branch that semi-paralleled the eastern branch to the south and going toward the surface valley in that area, where it was ultimately terminated by the flowstone chokes. Apparently the cave had continued in that direction, but the surface was too permeable at that point and let so much water down in there that it jammed it with flowstone and dripstone. And
oh, wow.
And then there was the
so it actually
branch.
Sealed itself off.
Yes, that's the way it looks that it did, and if you could get past it right down, there'd probably be a lot more cave in that general direction.
Hmm.
But that does illustrate what an ancient cave it must have been. And ultimately, in fact, it was found by Victor Polyak and the colleagues, but some of the materials related to the dissolution of the cave were datable by nuclear technologies,
mm-hmm.
and the old materials were found to date as far back as, I think, 4 million years.
Wow.
For caves, that's a relatively old thing. And the eastern branch proved to be the most challenging because one had to do major up and down rope climbing, getting through to the innermost regions in there.
And so east, southwest, what was the third direction?
Pardon?
There was a easterly direction, a southwest direction, and you mentioned three directions, so I was curious about the third one.
I was just then talking about the east one, actually. I had switched from southwest and...
Oh, okay.
And the eastern direction turned out to be the most strenuous and challenging exploration because it involved much more complicated up and down climbing than the other directions had.
Up and down, as in using ascenders to.
Oh yes. Okay. Yeah, using descenders and ascenders and for hundreds of vertical feet.
Wow.
Up and down.
And then, are you talking about spending multiple days underground?
Oh yes, multiple days. Once we started camping, we got that approved because the original days when we weren't allowed to camp were running into 30 hours, and that was really rather dangerous to get that exhausted and
get
the usual food and sleeping routines. And we persuaded the park that camping in the cave was not only justified but necessary if we were going to proceed much farther. And so they approved that, and we started establishing localized campsites in the different branches.
Oh, okay. Was Ron Kerbo still your contact with the park?
Yes, I believe he was at that point, although that did change later. He retired from there.
Okay. What sort of management challenges did you have with the park at this time? Do you recall?
Well, during Kerbo's period, we didn't have really problems with park management.
Okay. So working with Kerbo was good.
Well, we liked him.
He
was a friend of mine before ever Wachigia was broken through.
Okay.
Better known for cave diving early on.
Okay. So, it just sounds like it was such a good deal to have someone, an expert in caving, working for the Park Service here in this position, to be able to liaison with the volunteers.
Yes. Without that, it would have been quite difficult to interface with park staff who had little real knowledge of caving, let alone of extraordinary, such world-class caving as Wachigia.
Yeah. And then can you tell me a little bit of, I don't know if you remember the details of this, of what the park came up with as far as camping underground was concerned.
Well, we had to apply, I believe, to camp in particular locations which had logistical advantages, being, say, centrally located near intersections in the cave, and we had to get their approval for certain techniques and whatnot. And you know, on their part, relatively early in the project, we have been using carbide miner lamps, which had been standard caving lighting for in my entire caving career,
right,
from the 50s onward and earlier than that. One bizarre and almost unique thing that we've been finding in the cave was deposits of elemental sulfur. And sulfur, as you probably know, is flammable, and if set on fire, it'll melt and burn and then produce extremely poisonous sulfur dioxide.
Right.
Some people in the park became concerned that since this was a possibility, and literally we were finding tons of elemental sulfur in
really?
Certain locations, yes.
How did that happen? How did that, do you have any idea, roughly, simply, for the listeners of this oral history and for me, myself, how do you form elemental sodium in a cave?
Not sodium, but sulfur.
Sorry, salt. Sulfur. Thank you.
That's actually part of the hypogene cave development process in virtually all of the Guadalupe caves.
Huh.
And it's a completely different mode of dissolution, speleogenesis, that had only come to be understood very well beginning in the late 1970s.
Hmm.
And had been one of the people that pioneered some of the scientific work in regard to that in the terms of having written up the presence of elemental sulfur in Cottonwood Cave, much higher in the Guadalupe Mountains. And then about that same time, others were recognizing that there was some reason to involve sulfuric acid in their interpretations of the cave. But initially, they were thinking in terms of iron pyrite, which will oxidize in an oxygenated environment and create sulfuric acid, but the amounts of sulfur being found in the Cottonwood Cave seemed excessive in terms of that origin, the pyrite not being that abundant. But it happened that since the Guadalupe Mountains were in an oil and gas field, that it had been found that hydrogen sulfide was abundant in the groundwater in that region.
Ooh.
And it occurred to me that that would be a much more likely, for one thing, more mobile mode of origin. So I suggested that when I wrote a paper that I called something to the effect of Carlsbad Cavern, a critical review of recent hypotheses, in which I proposed a coherent mechanism for caves like Carlsbad being formed primarily by sulfuric acid rather than the traditional carbonic acid that one gets from soil and organisms and the like. And that explains so many things that are weird about the Carl's Bed. And I have not been the first one, actually, to suggest that. There was a cave scientist from back east, whose name I am having trouble coming up with, and he had found hydrogen sulfide in an active cave with a spring stream coming out of it in northern Wyoming.
Okay.
And he had sent a letter to Carl's Bed Cavern and suggesting that this would work for Carl's Bed. And when I happened to be working there in 1970, I happened to read that letter in the park headquarters. And I didn't, that was early enough that I didn't really have a mental category, really, for that kind of speleogenesis. But I did remember it, and it was after my time working at Carl's Bed around 1978 that I remembered that letter after we began to find sulfur. And at that point, the research on that began exploding until it became an entire sub-discipline of cave science with hypogene cave developments, which could either be powered by sulfide activity or by carbonic acid. But since that time, it's been a major sub-discipline in speleology to study and understand the features of hypogene caves, and specifically sulfidic ones.
So is the concept here, I mean, I think of the concept of calcium carbonate being in water, and if you evaporate out the water, you leave the calcium carbonate behind, and if you...
That's how the caves get decorated.
Right, if you do enough of that, you can make a stalactite or a stalagmite. Is the concept the same, that if you have hydrogen sulfide and you evaporate out the water, you're left with a sulfur that then deposits?
Sulfur, more often, though, it will not stop oxidizing at the stage of elemental sulfur. It'll usually, if there's oxygen enough, go on to form the sulfuric acid, and that's what does the speleogenesis. And a product of that then is gypsum. And one of the mysteries in Carl's Bed Cavern for many years had been that the big room in particular had deposits of massive gypsum up to 15 or more feet thick.
Wow.
In the drier parts of the big room in particular. And previous science had assumed that was probably gypsum coming from the higher formations in the Permian rocks, which were rich in gypsum, and then evaporating in the big room. But it turned out that instead it was a primary gypsum deposited at the same time the big room was being attacked by sulfuric acid in the ceiling and walls, and then that was coming down to the water table in the floor of the room, and then evaporating and depositing the massive gypsum in there. And Lechuguilla turned out to have more, way more gypsum and such deposits that we are actually calling them gypsum glaciers.
Wow.
It was a deposit, as if you were walking on a huge snowbanks, and at the edges where they might have been truncated by dripping water, there would be crevasses and bergschrunds, all these equivalents of the names given to glacial features.
Hmm.
So we were actually finding the gypsum glaciers, and calling them out of here and what you hear say.
So I'm confused, Donald. I'm confused. How would, well, you mentioned you were finding elemental sulfur. How come that didn't turn then into gypsum?
Sulfur is actually not that reactive if it happens to be deposited in the elemental form. But it does react slowly with atmospheric oxygen. In fact, one of the ways we could tell that we were approaching sulfur in Lachigia was that you began to be able to smell it.
Oh.
It would taint the smell of the air for hundreds of feet downwind from a major sulfur deposit. And sure enough, if we were just to follow that scent, we'd end up finding the sulfur. And probably the reason that most of it went on to gypsum rather than being deposited as sulfur is that the sulfur tended to stop the chemistry or slow it down in odds, sort of backwaters in the cave, which were apparently not as well oxygenated. Sometimes it was at the base of sandy overlying beds where the water was stagnant. And we think that that's what provoked the deposit of major sulfur of that sort. But in terms of tonnages, the gypsum is at least an order of magnitude or two more abundant than elemental sulfur.
Huh. Okay. Well, so before we started talking about sulfur, you were saying that carbide lamps, because of their open flame, could possibly light the sulfur on fire. So what did you do? How did you... I mean, it's a good, valid concern.
Well, a lot of cavers had actually been going increasingly to electric lights, initially to the commercial wheat miners' lamps that used heavy belt-mounted sulfuric acid batteries and ordinary light bulbs in them.
Right.
But the carbide actually was coming to be inadequate for us anyway, because what you cave is commonplace to encounter new chambers that were 100, 150 feet across, or maybe 100 feet high, and the carbide just couldn't be focused well enough to see far enough in the works of voids. And so we were not all that reluctant to follow their dictate and stop using carbide. And then as time went on, the electric lights were improving. Bulbs were going through phases of krypton, I think, and so forth. And then ultimately into LEDs. And we initially didn't much like the newest LEDs because they had this bluish cast of light that was rather annoying to see by. But faster and faster, they began to change the available LEDs to where you had good white beams. And with those things, you could focus for 100 feet quite well. And the batteries were also being improved, both non-rechargeable and rechargeable batteries, which was part of what improved our rates of discovery. We were able to simply see better.
And the carbide, of course, when you're done with you start with sort of tooth-sized, you know, human tooth-sized chunks of carbide.
Right.
And then they basically turned a muddy mush in your carbide lantern. And you knock that stuff out and drop in some more of the carbide crystals, pellets. Then that muddy mush is dumped in a cave, and that's probably not good for the cave environment.
No, that was one of the ethical and aesthetic problems in earlier organized caving, but many early cavers just didn't see fit to carry out the carbon waste. But by the time I started caving, that was about over with, and the routine had come to carry a container for the used carbide and dump into that and carry it out of the cave, and which was, of course, much neater. But in my earlier caving period, it was all too common to run across older people's carbide dumps in the cave. And one of the specialties of later caving became restoration, and one of the forms of restoration and people doing that would be to try to collect all the carbide dumps they could find and manage to get the stuff off the ground and remove it. So it's now pretty rare. You have to go into a passage where the cavers were already caving by the 50s or 60s if you even want to find a carbide dump.
Interesting. So when I think about camping underground, a couple other things come to mind. One of them is something that happens when you camp above ground, and that is if your partners snore. Did y'all kind of require the use of earplugs so that the snorers could snore and the people who didn't snore wouldn't stay awake listening to the snorers snore?
Well, it's something that depends on the people you were with at the time. I didn't find a big problem with the people I was caving with, but I was perhaps just lucky in that respect. And
you might have been the snorer, and you slept well, and you never knew it.
Well, if I was, nobody complained about it.
Right. They were too polite. Yeah.
I always hated wearing earplugs and having anything stuffed in my ears. That alone would keep me awake.
Then the other thing is solid human waste. Of course, if you're going to camp out, that needs to be removed, and you'd have to put it somewhere where it wouldn't smell out your kitchen area. And
yes, we would have to establish a latrine area near camp, and initially we had to carry out the solid waste, and usually the way to do that would be to shit in gallon plastic freezer bags and seal, make several layers and seal them, and then carry it out like that. And but urine posed a bigger problem because, and certainly in my case, I tended to produce about a gallon of urine per day at that time.
Okay.
And there was already talk going on about requiring carrying that out as well. And most of us just weren't willing to try it because 5 gallons would weigh something like 40 pounds of additional weight you'd have to drag up 900 feet or so out of the cave, and that would have been prohibitive for me. I just couldn't have done it that way. So at least until I gave up caving in Wachigia, we were still using local urine dumps at the campsites in the cave. I think now they may actually be requiring people to haul the urine out as well. I haven't thought about that recently.
I would think that then that's going to limit your distance ability underground. If you're going 40 or 50 miles and you have to haul, in theory, there's water in the cave that you can drink. So you don't have to haul your water in, but you have to haul your used water, your urine, you have to haul that out. So
that's what I was just saying. We'd set up the urine dump areas, and they got stinky, but
right.
usually the stench would be noticeable or particularly noticeable only for a few weeks, and then would be just faint the next time you were camping on another expeditionary trip. But that is a problem, although when I described the mileage in the cave, say, well, we had a celebration at the 50-mile mark, that doesn't mean that people were actually going and hiking 50 miles and back in one passage in the cave.
Okay.
But rather, there was no place in La Chiquilla Cave more than maybe 6 or 7 miles. And by the way, you had to travel from the entrance, mostly less than that. So it wasn't as strenuous as it might sound.
Okay, so that 40 or 50 miles is a combination of all kinds of passageways going in a bunch of different directions, and the actual geographical footprint may only be 6 or 7 miles in diameter.
Less than that, and actually, it ended up being about 10,000 by 5,000 feet.
Oh, wow.
But that was a different matter when we got to Fort Stanton Cave, where we actually do have a trend there where to get to the farthest part of the cave, which is about 8 miles in a straight line between the two most extreme ends of survey, but it's more than 12 miles now to the end of the Virgin, or to the beginning of the Virgin section.
Wow.
And we titled our book about Fort Stanton Cave, 12 Miles from Daylight, because the fast and light cavers, as they're being called, have to go that far along the route that they take before they actually get to a new survey area.
That's amazing.
In that sense, it's a harder cave than La Chiquilla was.
So when you mentioned...
Although it's almost horizontal.
Which is handy. When you mentioned La Chiquilla, you've got sort of 5,000 feet by 10,000 feet. What's the third dimension to that size?
1,600 feet vertically. And that was an important aspect in my work at La Chiquilla Cave. I had been caving in the Guadalupe Mountains since about 1960, and I realized at the time that the Guadalupe Mountains had 2,000 feet of massive limestone and dolomite, so that in theory, if you start in the lower end, you should be able to get to the water table in one of those caves if it went deep enough.
Mm-hmm.
But Carlsbad Cavern was, for a long time, the deepest known cave in that area, and it was not much over 1,000 feet deep, with the water table another 200 feet below there. And then in the upper gods, we were able to find the deepest wild cave that was, I think, 720 feet of survey. But we just, for decades, we were not able to find anything that was going to be anywhere near the water table. And it was a bit of a frustration. But once we started exploding in La Chiquilla Cave, we just kept setting new depth records. And eventually, we found that we were going deeper than Carlsbad, and that we had no reason to think that it wouldn't go farther.
Hmm.
And I was in the Far East one day looking for a new place to explore, and in the what we named the Outback, the most remote part of the Far East, which was a maze around the 1,000-foot level. So I had a team of 3 people with me, and they were down with me in the Outback, And we were going along the edge of that, and I noticed this slot over to the left side. And I suggested, well, that looks interesting. Let's see what happens down there. And my partners weren't altogether enthused looking about it. They thought they might find more by staying in the outback level, which was still going horizontally, but I prevailed, and we began surveying down that slot, and it turned out to be down climbable without rope, although quite steep on the average of 60, 70 degrees in a lot of it. But it just kept going and going and going down, and eventually we began to see on the walls ribs of calcite, which were an incipient folia, which is a relatively uncommon speleothem type that constitutes a contoured ribs or ridges along the cave wall and out on overhanging rocks specifically, that look like somebody had tried to make a contour map along the wall of the cave. And we found those in the other deepest part of the cave in the western branch, or in the southwestern branch before that, but it pinched out down there before we got very deep. So anyway, we were surveying down off the outback, and where we hit the folia, the slot kept going down, and the folia got more and more well developed until they were quite a spectacular feature, lining every vertical and overhanging surface in the slot.
Wow.
And as we were mapping, I was leading the point setting, and I began to see green below. And it became apparent that there was water down underneath there. So finally, we worked our way down, and sure enough, we came to water, green water, standing in there with calcite rafts on part of that pond, and the water just going down out of sight. And at that point, I was pretty sure we had found the water table, and it turned out to be true. It was down there about 1,500 feet from the top survey in the cave.
Wow.
So ultimately, later on, the cave divers got back in there.
Oh, my gosh. A whole new level.
Yes,
oh my gosh.
Way down there, and they were able to get more than 90 feet down, and it was still, it wasn't still going down. It went off to the sides to some degree, but that is now the deepest known place in the cave, and only divers have access to that point now.
Are they hoping that they will be able to come back up? And get and get into other areas.
I'm not sure if it was still going like that laterally. I just don't remember what they said about that possibility. But my impression is that it wasn't easy going. It wasn't wide fissure very long, and I don't think they found any air bells elsewhere along it.
Okay. You know, it's one thing when you're at a rubble pile and there's air moving through it, and you can say, okay, well, I think we can go here because we can feel the air. But when you get to water, you know, that kind of stops the transfer of air. It acts as a cork, if you will.
That does that.
And so, you know, how does that work? So during this time in the 80s, it sounds like you were spending a lot of time at Fort Stanton and Lechuguilla.
I flatter myself that I was good at predicting where we should be going.
Okay. And it sounds like your Grand Canyon work was not, well, sort of took a back seat to some of these bigger discoveries.
Yes, it's true that starting in 1986, I noticed just looking at the NIU's list of my correspondences with Harvey Buchert that I began to write him less frequently starting in 86.
Okay.
Though I continued a few more years, but I didn't get to do as much in the canyon myself after that.
Okay. But some caving you did do in the canyon happened in the 1990s, and I think we're going to kind of leave Lechuguilla here in Stanton, Fort Stanton.
Yes.
And head to head back to the Grand Canyon with Steve Emsley.
Yes.
How did that come about that you ended up tying in with him?
Good question. And it's not actually coming to mind just how I got in contact with him.
And I don't know if he was doing his caving work with Jim Mead at the time. I'm not sure if that name rings a bell.
Well, he certainly was overlapping my activity there. And the one trip that was most interesting turned out to be either my last or nearly my last successful trip in the canyon, and that was in Little Nankoweap. And I'm trying to remember the name of the caver that I was friends with who had gotten involved with Emsley as his climbing leader. He just recently got back in touch with me, too, and I've already gotten to where I have trouble. I don't even recall his name.
Let's see, I'm thinking, it's not Hans Bodenhammer.
I know it was a later person, although I knew Hans Bodenhammer and liked him.
Yeah.
So near, nearly recalled.
I'm drawing a blank there. And I know that Little Nankoweap was dealing with, I think, Stevens Cave and some of the other caves in that general area at the top of the Red Wall.
Yes, when I made my 1981 river trip, I actually noted the entrance, which would turn out to be Stevens Cave, from the river at the point where Marble Gorge widened out into Little Nankoweap. And I was recording every cave entrance I could see on my topo maps in that river trip. But I didn't get to go back there until a bit later. And then I found that someone had beaten me to Stevens Cave. And, Stevens, I guess I am.
Right.
But we found that he hadn't by any means exhausted the cave potential. In fact, there was another cave around the corner there that they ended up calling Shrine Cave because it had half a dozen stone cairns with split twig figurines associated with them, and our access to the cave was sufficiently hairy along narrow ledges that we were doing belayed traverse to getting in. But the split twig figurine people, maybe they were. I'm sure they were able to make ropes if they wanted to.
Yep.
They had gone into this thing and put that in, and we later found that if you continued from the back of Shrine Cave, that you would come into Stevens Cave. So it ended up that it was a double entrance system going through that buttress. And then a bit farther west, where that red wall mesa had a cutback to the north, and that's a way out that people from the river can get to the rim and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
It also had a big cave entrance, and we managed to get up to that, and we found that it was by far the longest of the caves that we encountered in that area. And we ended up surveying more than 3,000 feet and calling that Crescendo Cave because one of the cavers on the trip had been frustrated up to that point and was disappointed with what they were finding. But this then gave us a sort of crescendo to the trip on the last day we had to spend there. So I was leading the point setting on that trip, and we'd been going back and forth through this complex maze of angular passages. It had very little decoration, although it did have some what appeared to be table salt crust on the ceiling. It tasted like salt, and but very dry cave. And so at one point I was following air through there, and I felt that it was coming down into this walking passage from a crawlway above. So I crawled up there, and sure enough, there was strong blowing air. But it was a belly crawl, and I couldn't move through it even with my hat on. So I took off my hard hat and set it to the side and left it there and continued crawling. And then abruptly the floor began to drop down, and I could only see straight forward. But when I looked straight out, I saw stars.
Oh, my gosh.
And it turned out we hadn't been paying attention to the time and didn't realize it had gotten to be a total dark night already. And I realized that if I continued past my waist, I was in danger of sliding down an angle of repose slope and head first off the red wall for 150 feet. So that was one of the more memorable moments in my entire caving career, which I managed to forestall and push myself back. And then when I did get the hat to where I could look down, I found that it had gone maybe 15 or 20 feet down, but that there was a little hollow at the bottom with a slight rise on the far side. And if I'd slid down, I probably would have gotten stopped there, but maybe not before I'd had a heart attack. I would have been looking forward to a very short end of my caving career. Anyway, that's the sort of little adventure that one tended to have in the Grand Canyon caving.
Oh my gosh. And the purpose of that expedition, if I have this right, was to look for a Pleistocene remains.
Well, just a moment. I finally remembered his name, Larry Coates.
Larry Coates. Okay, I've heard of that name before.
Yeah, okay. And then, I feel like Lamsley was apparently interested more in the archaeology, I think, than other things in paleontology. And so we did have one day where we went all the way around Little Dam Coep on the Red Wall Rim so that we could check entrances on the far side that you could see heading south off the rim in that area.
Right.
And we found the first cave, I think, that we hit had a lot of guano and so on in the entrance chamber. And this was the first of the Grand Canyon caves where I had found condor remains.
Ah.
Now this, I think it was before they had reintroduced them into the canyon.
Right.
You might remember what year that was. I don't know, but...
I don't.
But I saw eggshells that were evidently broken condor eggshells, and then there was a feather shaft, and that feather shaft blew my mind just looking at it. And that was 3/4 inch thick, if it was an inch or
wow. If
it was a millimeter, and a foot and a half or so long. And I immediately realized that this is the bigger, way bigger than any bird's feather I've ever seen.
Do you think it was a teratorn?
I think it was simply a California condor.
Okay. Because there was a flightless, but another bird called the teratorn, a little bigger than a condor in the Pleistocene.
Yes, I know about them. I never actually found any fossils. I don't know that teratorn fossils have been reported from the Grand Canyon, but again, you might know.
I don't. I check with Jim Meader.
I hadn't thought of that at that time. But it was so big, even without being a teratorn, whatever it was, it was mind-blowingly large. And I have heard at some point that some Indian tribes had this, what they called the Thunderbird legend, which was an exceptionally large bird, but it was involved in their mythical concepts, and some people had hypothesized that might have been an ancestral memory of the California condor.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I saw that feather shaft, I became, if not exactly a convert to that idea, certainly more entertaining of it that an Indian might have been in the area just as I was, but earlier, and at that time, condors still did, in fact, I think, live in Arizona. I think there were very early records of live condors.
Absolutely.
So yep. the Puebloans probably did see them, and perhaps they were already using the Thunderbird concept for them.
Well, you would certainly get that with a 3/4 inch thick feather shaft. That's just stunningly phenomenal.
Yes.
Yeah. Huh. Did you guys get helicopter support to get in there to Little Naqueep?
Yes, that's how we got down. It would have been difficult to spend that long a time if we'd had to take a day at each end for just hiking out.
Mm-hmm.
I have
mm-hmm.
been there by hiking from the, what's the name of the terrace up there? The
Saddle Mountain?
Well, yes.
Or the House Rock Valley?
House Rock Valley, yes. So okay. I have gone there on one trip from that approach. But in this case, yes, we were doing that by helicopter on that same hike when we saw the feathers. I had an interesting little semi-adventure. I had an apple in my food supply that was in my rucksack at the time, and it somehow fell out as we were walking the rim and bounced off, and I went over and looked, and it had fallen down a 20-foot cliff onto the next redwall ledge, and I was quite frustrated because I'd been really counting on that apple for lunch, and so I gave it up, and we went farther west, and then we're coming back to the east for some reason. I forget why it worked exactly that way, but all of a sudden, I found half of my apple on the Red Walrium, where a raven had apparently left it. I found half of it had been beak marked and eaten and then left there. So I'm the only person I know who shared their lunch with a raven without even meeting her.
At the top of the Red Wall in the Grand Canyon.
Indeed.
How lovely is that? Huh. Very nice.
I should remind you again that when I give these details, it's quite possible that I've gotten things wrong, and I may have conflated different trips and that sort of thing, so I'm not to be trusted to be telling the whole truth about all this.
Well, this is true for
a lot of this I did write down in such a way that I can recheck if anyone needs to know.
This is true for all oral histories. So you're not alone there in that. Was that your last caving adventure in Grand Canyon?
No, I think my last one, that was certainly one of them, but the last one that was fully successful was, I think, I need again to check my files, but I think it was as late as 1996, when I had wanted to, ever since 1965, when I had first hiked to the source of the Bright Angel Creek, and beyond the tributary where the Roaring Springs joins it.
Mm-hmm.
You follow Roaring Springs Canyon, which a few people seem to do.
Right.
You eventually come to the source of that water, which contributes about half the water in the creek.
Oh.
And from a bedding plain in the middle of limestone, there's a horizontal slot and a certain intersection of a vertical crack there where the water comes out in part, and higher water it apparently issues rather broadly from that bedding plain, and but lower water in the fall or winter, usually you don't see the water except at a lower bedding plain, and you can barely crawl into an entrance there, and it blows a lot of air.
Hmm.
So I had organized a trip and actually applied through the full Grand Canyon permit process to do this, and promised them a surveyed map of the cave. So I organized a team to do that, and it turned out I learned that somebody had beat me to that spring a couple of years earlier and had found that there is cave in there, but they didn't do any mapping, and I don't think they had a permit even. So anyway, we found that you could crawl 10 feet to a cross crack, and beyond that, there was a couple of inches of water coming along this pitted floor and through a belly crawl. How did I figure that? Anyway, we had to dress to wade, or not wade, but to crawl in the water, which was probably in the 50s temperature range.
Sure.
Not ice cold, but too cold to be at all comfortable.
Right.
And we did do that, and it was reminiscent to me of a Wyoming cave, Great Expectations, that has a lower entrance that goes through a belly crawl all hackly with this rough limestone, and they named that the Grim Crawl of Death because it was so ugly a crawlway. But this thing reminded me of a smaller version of what I'd heard about that. But I was really fearful, but I overcame my dread of getting stuck in that water flow and crawled through there. And luckily, I was just small enough to fit without getting stuck. And if I had gotten stuck, I'm afraid the water would have ended up coming right up over my nose and mouth. I got too tired to hold my breathing apparatus out of the water.
Right.
But luckily, it ended up, the crawl was 90 feet altogether.
Wow.
But it broke into a walking passage. I ended up surveying more than 1,000 feet of Maze Cave.
Wow.
Pretty reminiscent of Roaring Springs Cave. But unfortunately, the main gallery broke down, much in the way the Deer Creek Spring Cave had, and just hit this rubble flow that would require digging to try to get by. Water was coming out down low. But that was the last thing that I did where we, it was an adventuresome trip in itself, because there had just been a forest fire race across that part of the North Rim. And we were going down there when there were still literally burning stumps down below. And we had to traverse part of the burned ground, literally days after the firefighters had gone through that. And then when we got around the corner of this tributary, where we descended and where we camped, and it rained heavily, we had to deal with that. So it was fire and water that whole hike, and more extreme than any I'd experienced in my earlier canyon caving, in fact.
And yeah.
So
do you think that this cave, clearly it does not connect with Roaring Springs, because it would be dewatered if it did?
Either it would be, or it could now be in the process of becoming. So if they do come from the same aquifer, which I don't know about, then there would be a tendency for one or the other to gain the speed of development and to dewater the one that was smaller and had less ability to compete, so to speak.
Right. It's almost like the lower cave would dewater the upper if it connected.
I think that's why, in fact, there are mesas at the entrance of Tapete's Cave and Thunder River Cave. They split into several passages there, and I think it's because the closer the stream passage comes to the outside, the steeper the gradient becomes into the developing surface tributary. So they begin to get pirated at some point, and the relationship between the surface and the stream passage keeps changing, so other passages tend to usurp from time to time, depending on what the surface has done in the meantime. Am I clear in what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And who were you caving with on that trip in 66 in 96 versus the Emsley trip of 93?
Well, there was a man from Wyoming that I was caving with, and let's see, run into the name problem again.
Ah, okay.
Another one was, I believe, Evan Anderson, who was a hardcore caver and good friends with him. I need to refer to my survey notes to actually
right
get a good record.
Right. And at this time, were you living in Denver?
Let's see. That was around the time when I started living in Denver. Most of the time, I was for decades, I was spending summers in Burleson and winters in Denver when I was doing the small-scale beekeeping.
Okay. All right.
But the last thing I attempted to do in the Grand Canyon failed. I was friends with some of the younger cavers from Durango, and they had made arrangements to go quite late in the season at the Chiava Falls Cave, and it was one of the earliest caves I had seen in the canyon in 65, I think, from across canyon when WSI people were going to it.
Right.
But I had never had a chance to go to it, and they had arranged to do a survey trip. So I was able to join that trip, and they drove us to the closest place to rope over the upper cliffs down toward there. And so I packed a lot of water because I wasn't sure if we were going to make it down to the water in the cave that same day. Probably not. But I found that I'd already just gotten too weak for doing what I was trying to do. And by the time I reached the top of the Coconino, I realized that I was nothing but a drag on the whole team. I couldn't keep up, and I was not going to be able to do that and get back in a safe and satisfactory way. So I just told them, this is no longer within my endurance level. So I will go to back to the truck, and just wait for you guys the three next days, which I did. And then I got snowed in, and that was a rather boring experience, waiting for them to come up. But they succeeded in doing what they intended, and the result was an extremely well-plotted, attractive map that they produced for the park.
How big a cave did they find there?
Only about 700 feet long, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
It ends in a sump. That is, when it's not running. It apparently is being pirated a few hundred feet back and coming out farther down the red wall. You can see water down at that level from across the creek.
Oh, I wonder if, because there is permanent water in Clear Creek, and I wonder if that water is coming from that water source. When there's a lot of water, then it has this overflow valve, if you will, at Chiava Falls.
Yes. I think that's the correct interpretation.
Okay.
We had to be rescued in the sense that by the time they got back, we were blocked by more than 6 inches of heavy snow. And they had to send in the park snowplow to get us out of there. This was in, I think, November, and we were the last visitors into the Walhalla Plateau route or highway that season. But fortunately, they didn't blame us for it.
Yeah, no worries. That's good.
But after that, I realized I simply was no longer fit for the level of outdoorsmanship that I'd been used to.
Mm. Aging climbers and aging cavers and comes to us all when we get old enough that doing these things becomes way more difficult.
Yes, so my end in Lafayette Cave was in 1999. I could still handle the caving then, but I realized I just wasn't enjoying it as I used to. By the end of the thing, I wanted out and was feeling stressed. And then at the end of that year, they closed the cave for 2 years in order to rebuild the entrance to the Cummer entrance culvert and gate. So they finally reopened it 2 years later. I just didn't try to go back. I realized that if I was already stressed in 99, it could only be worse since I'd had a couple of years of slack and would have to get back in the groove, so to speak, to even contemplate doing good work in Lachigia.
Right, right.
But luckily for me, just around that same time in 2001, some of my other caving friends made a big breakthrough in Fort Stanton Cave, which was a Snowy River breakthrough. After a multi-year dig, they broke into a fine passage, a gallery that they came to, and it had this snow white stripe running down along the bottom of the floor. What appeared to be a former stream channel that had become totally calcified, and this thing not quite like any of them had seen. And then the BLM, which administers that cave, I decided, well, you've made the breakthrough, and now we have to decide what to do with it. And it ended up taking them 2 years to do their environmental impact study and so on. But the cave had gone out of sight either way, but the discovery team didn't even get onto the passage floor. They left it alone because the agreement with BLM had been that if they broke through into something, they wouldn't scoop it, but would tell the park or tell the BLM what they'd found, and BLM had the ultimate authority, which they did. So
right.
they delayed things for 2 years, and finally, in 2003, they opened it up to us, and we began to explore, and we had this little fun contest just before that in which the several old-timers who'd been caving there for decades tried to make their predictions. What was Snowy River going to do? How far would it go before it ended, if it did end? And so the shortest distance was for 1,000 feet to a terminal breakdown, and the longest distance was 70 miles, which was my own guess.
Oh, my.
And it ended up that I was actually the closest one to guess that, because it's now more than 44 miles.
Wow.
And it's still going like mad to the south with strong airflow. It's come almost under the bed of the next major drainage. And it has had intermittent flooding as the problem. The cave is still taking water, we think, from Eagle Creek, which is almost as far again as the cave is known to extend already. But when Eagle Creek floods, so does Snowy River. For the first couple of years, we didn't even realize that it ever ran water because it was dry when we first began exploring it. Although there are a few clues, like the fact that there was almost no mud or stones on the Snowy River deposit, which should have told us that it must have been growing relatively recently, and then it turns out, in fact, when we finally dug a shorter way into there after another year and a half of digging from a different part of the old cave that would bypass the difficulties in the original discovery route, when we came back to it, we found it running water, this beautiful stream that was green and trickling along at a very leisurely rate, with little ripples and whistles, and quite a beautiful sight to see, but except that we had to wait for it to go away in order to explore along it. We weren't willing to try to wade through it. Technically, you could, but we'd found that there was at least one place where it would sump during a flood, and if you were there when the flood came through, you would be trapped and probably die of starvation before you could even be rescued.
Not a lot of fun.
Yeah. So one of the rules was we had to do this only when the cave was dry. And as it turns out, that this 44-mile distance is running neck and neck with the longest Grand Canyon cave now that Jason Belinsky has discovered off the North Rim. And the name of the biggest cave in that cluster is Double Whopper Cave, and it and Snowy River are neck and neck for which one is longer right now.
So you mentioned that to get into Snowy River, it was 2 years of digging?
More than 2 years. We started way back in the 60s.
Oh, my gosh. So is that the sort of deal like Lechuguilla? You can feel air hitting your face. You can see small bits of dirt and dust blowing around. So you try to keep digging, but you have to dig a long ways.
Yes, that was it.
Okay.
There had been air from one section of Fort Stanton Cave for the entire known history of the cave. But that was a massive breakdown choke, and that was a dig just getting to that final 1,000-foot passage in there. That happened, I think, in 1969, perhaps. That's another date to check for certainty. But that was a breakthrough after quite a lengthy series of digs already. But it ended after a single huge passage and another enormous breakdown mass with bigger rocks than we'd been accustomed to. We made a few prying digs into that and even used blasting at one point to get past a choke. But it ended just becoming impassably difficult to pursue. And the wind continued to come out of there.
Wow.
So we refocused our efforts on other digs. On one of those, what was called Priority 7, which also had a strong airflow, but it was 2,000 feet farther south or so, maybe 1,500 feet farther south in the original, or I mean farther north in the original cave. And when we started working in there, it seemed pretty hazardous. And I was on the last early dig where we'd worked in there for a while and come to this enormous rock poised overhead that looked just exceedingly risky to pursue digging under. And I was going back out of there at the time and grazed the ceiling, and the rock about a foot square went sliding past my ear and crashed on the floor beside me. And if my head had been 6 inches farther over, I think I would have just been killed then and there. And that scared me off quite a bit. And I think that was the last dig we attempted until 1999. And then a few of the cavers had not altogether lost faith in that dig and began working there again and got past that massive block without it falling. And that was the dig that made the major breakthrough for man dig that got through into the snowy river area. And since that time, it's been the Mammoth Cave of the West, which I thought of it all along as. And I'd first seen it in 1960 and had the interest ever since then. And so it is still going, and I'm still part of the project, even though I'm no longer fit for the physical part. But I am fit for the scientific part.
Nice.
And I take part in the discussions and publications about it.
Excellent. So still remaining as active as you can?
Yes.
Lovely. That's good.
Well, it's been my chief passion for most of my life, starting 80 years ago.
And you've done an amazing job with that.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So, Donald, in the material we've covered, this sounds like it might be a good place to wrap up this oral history. What do you think?
That's up to you, basically. You're the leader of that project.
Well, I'd simply ask you then, what
if
else?
It's suitable to me.
Okay. If it's suitable to you, that's good. I think we've done really well to cover what we've covered. So,
how many other people are you doing this with at this time?
I have two other ongoing interviews right now.
In regard to the canyon?
Yes. Yeah.
Which ones are they?
Frank Barrios, historian, career with the Central Arizona Project for Bureau of Reclamation. And Tick Siegerblum is a Nevada state legislator, grew up in Boulder City and spent a lot of time on Lake Mead and ended up boating with Doc Marston in 1963 on the low water sport yak trip. So just meeting amazing people like yourself that have done amazing things, and it's an honor to be able to go with you as we wander on these journeys.
And that second person you're interviewing?
Yes, is a Tick Siegerblum.
Would you repeat that one?
Tick, Richard is his first name, and Segerblom is how we spell his last name. You know what, let's go ahead and we'll wrap this up now. This will then conclude part 9 of a Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Donald Davis. Today is Sunday, February 5th, 2023. And Donald, thank you so very, very much for taking the time to do these oral histories.
I'd forgotten you hadn't already hit the switch when I said the last question.
Right, no worries. So we'll talk here in a minute, and thank you again.
Okay.